Welcome to Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, A.C. Felder, and today the topic is the icons of evolution. And to discuss this with me, I have Trisha Scribner. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right, let me tell you about Trisha. She possesses a bachelor's and master's degree in science toward nursing. Mm-hmm. She teaches apologetics and New Testament at Hickory Grove Baptist Christian High School in Charlotte, right. North Carolina. She has written a number of books on Christian mentoring. She currently writes for a women's magazine and has contributed numerous articles on topics such as Christian leadership, medical and health issues from a biblical perspective. And she is currently pursuing a master's degree in apologetics from Southern Evangelical Seminary. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
What did I leave out?
Not a thing. You covered it well.
I left out some important stuff, though.
I am a mom.
There you go.
I'm a mom.
There you
I have
go.
Three girls.
There you go.
They're about grown, but we enjoy them. I have grandbabies, and I've been married for about 30 years.
So. See, women are better. I have guys on the show, and I throw them that pitch, and they're like, oh, no, I'm done. No, what about your wife? Oh, okay. See, women are so much better. Okay, Trisha, we're going to be talking about the icons of evolution. So let's start out talking about evolution. So what is evolution?
Well, evolution really, if we just take it in its broadest sense, just means change over time. Okay, so you and I both, we would agree, are changing over time. I don't know about you, but I'm changing over time.
I got some gray hairs that
will testify
to that.
So most of us, though, when we use that word, don't mean that general term. We more or less are referring to this ideology called Darwinian evolution, which says that first life occurred by chance, and that subsequent life in diverse forms arose out of a single ancestor all the way through man. And so that's what we usually mean when we talk about evolution in the public setting.
Yeah, and I hear that there's a distinction between what we call macroevolution and microevolution. Could you explain the difference?
Sure, and we have to remember too that we attach these words that aren't familiar to us, and so we shouldn't be intimidated by that. We just need to look up a couple of things, and most of us would know that micro means small and macro means big, and that's exactly how it applies to the term of evolution when we use it or when scientists use it. Microevolution is something we all believe. It simply says that species adapt to their environments. Let's say if you were in a snowy environment and you noticed mostly white rabbits, and you would say, how did the white rabbits all become white? Well, because the brown ones were seen by the predators more easily, and they didn't survive because they would be hunted down and more easily seen. So we see how this species then adapted over time to its environment within the species. But that's microevolution, and nobody has a problem with that. Christians, we all see that.
Right.
Adaptation to the environment and within species. But what we don't see is what Darwin asserted, that over millions and millions and millions of years, these small infinitesimal almost changes would create big changes across species into different life forms. That would mean an amoeba is a fish, is a frog, is a turtle, is a chicken, is a man, all from one earliest life form. That would be macroevolution. That's what we disagree with. And usually, though, people don't discriminate between those two terms. They usually just say evolution, and they're talking about the idea of macroevolution.
Right.
Only scientists generally are speaking in those terms. But it's a good distinction for us as Christians and the laity to know so that we can just talk intelligently with those who do use those terminologies.
And I'm sure that's what we're about to get into because
a little bit more.
What Darwinists have done is they have taken this microevolution and they have made this huge leap and they say, okay, well, if things can change, you know, over a given small amount of period of time, then, you know, over a large amount of time, then it can change into something else.
Mm-hmm.
Although it never changes from one thing to another, you know, they talk about bacteria. Well, it changes into other bacteria. A mouse, it doesn't change into a kangaroo.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So, but I'm sure we're going to get into that a little bit more. So let me just go ahead and get into the crux of the issue that we're going to be discussing today. And the topic is the icons of evolution. So, Trisha, tell me, what are the icons of evolution? What are we talking about when we say the icons of evolution?
It means something, and I'll tell you that in just a moment. But first, I want to give credit to Dr. Jonathan Wells, who has a PhD in molecular and cellular biology, who wrote a book called Icons of Evolution. And he is talking about, when he refers to the icons of evolution, the handful of major evidences that most evolutionists use to support their reason for believing in evolution at all, okay, for believing that all of the present life forms are descendants from a single ancestral form, and that first life happened by chance, that there is nothing outside of nature, that this natural world or universe is all that exists. So that's what those evidences that are most often used are what are called icons of evolution. They've become sort of like landmarks, right, for evolutionists. And this is what we also find in our high school textbooks. Right. These examples that are used across the board in our high school biology textbooks by scientists who speak on evolution, as well as by the laity. They may not call them icons, but that's the main evidences that they refer to, or examples, to support their belief in evolution.
Okay, before we get into the actual icons, mm-hmm, I wanted to clear something up. Why is this important for Christians to study? Why should Christians care whether evolution is true or not?
Mm-hmm. You know, Christianity makes historical claims, it makes scientific claims, and we as Christians believe that the Bible is true and accurate in every point on every subject which it teaches or touches, as Dr. Norman Geisler would say. And while it's not a science book per se, we cannot be Christians and believe in naturalism, that evolution occurred, that there was no designer to begin with.
Right.
That's not compatible with Christian life. The
right.
other reason, for most of us who believe the Bible, number one, we often don't think through why we believe it. And what I find with my high school students is they get into college and they are sitting before an awe-inspiring professor who posits these arguments, and they have nothing to say. Two things happen. One, they begin to doubt.
Yes.
And we lose them during their young adult years. Very often, they abandon the faith during those years because we have not equipped them. And that's what we're trying to do now,
yes,
in Christian high schools, is get better at that. And number two, we're unable to engage the lost. And
yeah.
God has called us to engage the lost. And these days, we can't walk in and say, the Romans Road says you are lost, God says you're all are sinners. We can start there, but what do we do and where do we go when the person says, I don't believe the Bible?
Right.
We have to start somewhere back here and take them toward the gospel logically.
Right.
So we need to know the evidence in our world around us in order to be able to engage other people and win a hearing for the gospel.
Yeah.
And evolution is a big part of that,
right,
because it's considered to be not a theory anymore,
right,
but it's fact, and
yeah,
it's assumed by many to be fact.
If evolution is correct, Christianity is wrong. That's the bottom line.
Bottom
That's
line.
Why it's so important, mm-hmm, for us to understand why Christianity and evolution are incompatible. So I'm sorry for the little side trail,
mm-hmm,
but I just wanted to
important.
Just lay the groundwork there. So I'll let you go ahead and get into the icons of evolution and let you talk about that a little bit now.
Okay, well then let's just touch on several of the main evidences or examples that are most often cited to support evolution and its beliefs. One of them is the fact of embryonic similarity among and across the board. They're called Haeckel's drawings. A 19th century biologist and artist drew the embryonic stage in several different types of vertebrates. For instance, in a frog, in a fish, in a chicken, and in a human. And what he noticed or tried to display was how similar these embryos were. And then evolutionists would surmise from that, or generalize from that, we all have one common ancestor. See, we look the same embryonically.
Right.
So they use that. That's one of the arguments that they use to say, see, we come from one common ancestor. Secondly, very often they talk about the Galapagos Island finches. What happened,
yes,
the Darwin noticed a variety of finches on the Galapagos Island, but one thing he noticed is that during drought, the beak's size changed. And it adapted, And he surmised from that that over time, given enough time, billions of years, not only would that beak size change, but adaptations would increase so much that it would produce new diverse forms, not just different types of finches, but a different type of life form altogether. Mm-hmm. Thus, we go from invertebrates to vertebrates. We go from first life through the ocean, fish, amphibians, reptiles, mammals, and then man being the highest. So you can see how far that you have to take this once you get on this boat. Yeah. You've got to take it all the way to the end. So they say that this change shows that it can propel evolution all the way forward to create these new life forms. So first of all, the first example that's most often used is the embryonic similarity, and then the second one is the Galapagos Island finches and the change when drought occurred in their beak size. And then the third one that's often is used is antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And as we all know, the scientists have produced antibiotic-resistant bacteria. We all know that we're in the phase where new antibiotics are being developed all the time, right, because of this problem. But in the laboratory, antibiotic-resistant bacteria have been created, have been produced, and so they say, aha, this resistant bacteria shows that a mutation could occur, and that through natural selection, that is chance, that this mutation would be picked up and develop new life forms, not just newly resistant bacteria, but mega bacteria, and that would produce a linear movement of change into new life forms. So that's the third argument they use. And then, let's see, I know there's one, oh, the four-winged fruit fly. The four-winged fruit fly. In the laboratory, scientists have produced a four-winged fruit fly. Now, you and I don't really care how many wings it's got, we just want to squash it, but most have two.
Right.
And so this is a development in which they say, aha, see, we can show that this mutation could be picked up and again produce new life forms if taken to its logical conclusion and given enough time and enough changes, produce new organisms of diverse forms. So this is used. And then finally, Darwin's Tree of Life is often cited as one of the best examples that evolution has really occurred, and that's how we've gotten to the diverse forms of today. It would be like down here at the bottom, there's the initial life form, and then all the diverse life forms branched and branched and branched off of that initial life form. So we're all just part of the same circle of life,
right,
so to speak. And it sounds very nice. So in that, they cite two supporting evidences for the Tree of Life, that this is the way it happened, and one is similar bone structure. For instance, a porpoise's fin has similar bone structure to the hand of a human, or if we look across different types of mammals, we will notice that many of them have bones that we have in a similar location, working in a similar way. All right, so they say, see, we have similar bone structures, so we must have come from the same line. All right, and then secondly, let's see, the homology is the first one, and second, the fossil record they use to support the Tree of Life reasoning. And they say, well, the fossil record shows many forms developing over time, and we can confront each of these examples and evidences with the hard evidence, and it takes us to a different conclusion than Darwin came to.
Let's follow it out then.
Okay.
What's wrong with these theories? Why do they not prove what they're trying to prove?
Well, I want to confess to you that I'm learning.
Okay.
I do not confess to be an expert, and that's why it's so important that we know that the average folks like you and me, mm-hmm, we can get in there and dig a little bit. And by the way, the folks that are watching your show today, it's like preaching to the choir. They're already people, mm-hmm, who are interested and care about what's going on in the world and becoming knowledgeable about the things they need to know in order to engage the lost, especially those who believe in evolution as far as the subject tonight goes. In order to address these, we need to understand that this is a naturalistic philosophy. Its foundation is in atheism, because if the universe exists and that's all there is, mm-hmm, and all of this came about by chance, there is no room for God. So you ask the implications for Christians. That's one of the implications. Now let's just look at the examples though, because as Christians, we want to know where the evidence leads. We can be assured that it will lead us back to God.
Right.
But at the same time, with a background in science, I do want to have good reasons for believing what I believe. And so let's talk about the very first one which we addressed was the embryo similarity. What we find in high school biology textbooks, the ones my students read and are taught from, fortunately they have a Christian teacher to analyze that for them and give them the truth, but these drawings are shown of the similarity of embryos of, say, a fish and a frog and a turtle and a chicken and man, and wow, they look similar. What the textbook may fail, not all of them, we've got some good textbooks out there, but what the textbook may fail to say is that Haeckel's drawings are outdated, and furthermore, many would assert that they are falsified, that Haeckel himself fudged. Plus, he was 19th century, didn't have quite as much information about the embryo as we do now, didn't have the ability technologically to view what we can view now. And what we know is that Jonathan Wells, a molecular biologist, as I mentioned to you, who wrote the book called Icons of Evolution, what he says is that, interestingly enough, Haeckel took the intermediate stage of embryonic development, the one where they're most alike. If he had gone even farther back, earlier stages, he would have found they were even more dissimilar.
Okay.
So he did a couple of things here. One, he actually fudged them according to his bias,
right,
okay, to make them look more similar. And we all have a tendency to do that. Okay? In fact, Christians are accused of doing that.
Right.
But Haeckel did that with the drawings. And secondly, he used an intermediate stage. And if he had gone back even earlier, he would have found they were more different than more similar. And if he had drawn them to scale, as Jonathan Wells has done, then you would see that they're dramatically different. There's very little similarity. So there's not much evidence there. Unfortunately, these pictures are not, they're public domain now and can be easily used. And that's one of the excuses that the folks that advocate this in the textbook say, well, they're copyright free and so we're able to use them, and they still prove the main point.
Right.
So we give them that, we don't argue with them. Oh, well, that's just one example. And if
right.
it was the only one, it wouldn't be that serious,
right,
but
we
it's
have
a problem.
Another one. Right. Mm-hmm.
Secondly, though, we also have a problem with the Galapagos finches, because what we find is that this does not show evolution in process. Actually, it just shows oscillation of adaptation. It never leads to fundamentally new life forms.
Right.
When drought comes, the beaks change, the animals adapt to their environment to survive.
Right.
Those who do not adapt die off, and the survival of the fittest, those who are most fit for that environment, live. But that does not mean that fundamentally new life forms are produced in this
right.
process.
It didn't
that
turn
has
into
not
a
been
monkey.
Shown.
Yeah, they didn't turn into
it did
a
not
monkey.
Turn into a monkey. And it didn't turn into a raven. It didn't turn into a buzzard,
right.
even. So this is very serious, and it's a very, very weak argument, and yet it was lauded as one of the greatest findings.
Right.
Now, thirdly, the antibiotic-resistant bacteria. I've not done a lot of lab work. When I was a nurse in nursing school, we did some lab work, you know, and you grow things in the little petri dishes, you know,
yeah.
things like that in lab. But what scientists have found is that of course, you put antibiotics into that petri dish with the bacteria, and it kills off the bacteria. That's what we want antibiotics to do, so we can get feeling better. Unfortunately, what we find is that there'll be a few resistant bacteria. Aha, they're stronger. Well, maybe then this, with enough time, would change into a whole new species, a whole new different set of organisms of diverse forms.
It's a big leap.
Yeah, it's a big leap, because what has been found is that when these bacteria, second generation bacteria, which are resistant, are put back with the parent bacteria, let's say the antibiotic is removed, they can't survive. So this is not a linear evolutionary move at all. They can't survive with their own parent bacteria. And so these examples that are being used are actually very weak. And then fourthly, the four-winged fruit fly.
Right.
It produced in the laboratory. There's a problem with that. When evolutionists say, well, see this four-winged fruit fly, look at the change that was produced by a mutation. Imagine random mutations are the engine, and if this four-winged fruit fly can show that kind of mutation, then it could, over enough time, develop into a whole new organism.
Right.
Okay? The problem is, that is a laboratory setting. It's an artificially produced mutation in a control setting, and it cannot survive on its own. No other fruit fly will mate with it, so it can't reproduce.
Well,
it's a dead
that,
end.
Yeah, and not only that, it took intelligence to create that.
It took intelligence, manipulating,
right,
to produce that environment. Further, the two extra wings, dead as a doornail. They're like carrying extra baggage. They don't do anything. They're non-functional. This is a dead end evolution for evolutionists. This does not show a linear progressive change that can account for the big changes, the intermediate stages that would take a frog to a human.
Right.
Even no matter how much time there is. And then finally, the tree of life. The tree of life says that, as I mentioned before, that we began with one archetypal organism, and it produced all these different diverse life forms. Homology is what is the similar bone structure. That's what we mean by similar bone structure. Scientists call it homology. A similarity in bone structure, they argue, shows that we come from the same ancestor. We are all living beings progress from the same ancestor. The problem with that is, even though a wasp and a bee are similar in structure, that doesn't tell us the mechanism how they got that way. Now, Darwin said that if the bone structure of different vertebrates are similar, like a cat has a femur, a leg bone called a femur, or that functions like a femur, then we must all be coming from the same genetic, original genetic code. The problem is that the genetic code that produces those similar bone structures are not the same. We have learned. You see, we're now in the 21st century, and we're able to look at the cell. We're able to look at some of the causative factors, and Darwin's theory falls flat in the face of the newest scientific evidence, despite the fact that some scientists still say that it does not. They are not thinking through their own position.
Yeah.
And then finally, the fossil record,
right,
is the other record that's often, the other example that's often used to support the tree of life. And Darwin postulated that over time, you know, all these diverse forms were produced. He didn't see it clearly in the fossil record, but he argued that over time, if we started sampling enough fossils,
right,
we would find these intermediate forms. Did we find them? We did not. What we have found is that there's a sudden burst in a certain strata of the rock layers called, supposedly from the what is called by scientists the Cambrian Age, that occurred at a certain point way back in history, where diverse life forms appeared all at once. And even below that strata, see, Darwinist argued, well, maybe below that strata, just before it, there will be the intermediate forms. There are not. They said, well, maybe it's because those forms that preceded them were too soft-bodied. Not so. In China, fossils have been found of very sponge embryos, very soft-bodied forms, and even the muscles are able to be shown and are grafted in the fossils. It just does not support Darwinian theory. And just getting a grasp on some of these basics will help Christians,
yeah,
to be able just to enter the arena of discussion.
Yeah. Well, and that's very good, because I know this book, The Icons of Evolution, there are a lot of these icons that the book talks about, but of course we're limited here on the show with a certain amount of time, so we only went through a few of them. But how do you respond to someone? Because what happens is, when you talk to someone who is an evolutionist, or who doesn't believe that God created, they will say that, well, what you believe in that God created, that's not science. That's not scientific. You can't teach that in a school. You can't teach that in the classroom, because it's not science.
Well, we have to realize that we all, every scientist, whether naturalistic in his view or Christian in his view, enters a laboratory setting with a worldview. Every one of us has a way that we think the world began, whether it was came from a purposeful creator or whether it happened by chance, we all have an opinion. So let's not assume that only Christians enter the laboratory setting or to study evolution, the only ones with a worldview. Right. Everyone filters what they see in the data through their worldview. So what we have to ask as scientists is, objectively speaking, where does the evidence lead us? And as much as possible, be objective about that. Now, I believe, not as a scientist, but with a science background, that the evidence itself supports everything I see in the Bible.
Right.
But I say that having some scientific background upon which to base that. So we wouldn't want to argue that just because you're a naturalist that you can't see the evidence, nor would we want to argue that just because you're a Christian you can't see the evidence. So let's just be sure that we make that playing field level and say that everyone, humanist, of which naturalism and evolution is a premise, asked to be called a religion in 1961, and the Supreme Court gave them that. So we're not the only religious folks that come as scientists to this arena to discuss this topic.
Right.
All of us and have a worldview.
The interesting thing about it is, we're closing the show up now, I told you the time was going by fast, mm-hmm. but the interesting thing is that although we are supposed to be the uneducated ones, that we are the ones who actually are looking at the true evidence, mm-hmm. it is the evolutionists who are turning a blind eye to the evidence mm-hmm. and just selectively looking at information to bolster up their own philosophy. So,
well, let's just say that there are many scientists out there who have questions about Darwinian evolution, mm-hmm. the theory in itself, and there are scientists who are not believers who have the same questions.
Right. Tricia Scribner, thank you for being on my show,
talking with me
about the icons of evolution. And that will end this episode of Giving an Answer. Be sure to join me again next time. And until then, goodbye and God bless.
Brother.